You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Rupert Murdoch, forever savvy about the next key outlet that will attract eyeballs, purchased MySpace, spending nearly $600 million so he could, in the language of Wall Street, monetize those eyeballs. Google became a partner in Time Warner, investing $1 billion in its AOL online service. And now Google has bought YouTube so it would have a better vehicle for delivering interactive ads for Madison Avenue. Viacom, Microsoft, large ad agencies, and others have been buying up key media properties, many of them the leading online sites, with the result that will be a thoroughly commercialized environment, a media plantation for the 21st century, dominated by the same corporate and ideological forces that have produced the system we have lived under the last 50 years.
That's Bill Moyers, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bill Moyers on media reform. A vibrant media is the oxygen of a living democracy. When the media are dominated by a handful of big corporations, citizens of a democracy are on a respirator gasping for air. James Madison, founding father, understood this well when he said, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but the prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives." Unquote. Today, media reform is an important issue. A growing grassroots movement is demanding change. Our guest today is Bill Moyers. He was a renowned journalist and commentator. He deplored what he called the increasing show business nature of much of corporate media. Bill Moyers was the host and producer of many of PBS's most heralded programs, and he was the winner of more than 30 Emmy Awards. He died in June 2025. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Memphis, Tennessee at the National Conference for Media Reform in 2007. And now, Bill Moyers.
Thank you. Please. Thank you for that most generous welcome. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for dinner." "Liberty," he said, "is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote." My fellow lambs, it's good to be in Memphis and find you well armed with passion for democracy, readiness for action, and courage for the next round in the fight for a free and independent press in America. I salute the conviction that brought you here. I cherish the spirit that fills this hall and the camaraderie that we share here. All too often, the greatest obstacle to reform is the reform movement itself. Factions rise, fences are erected, jealousies mount, and the cause all of us believe in is lost in the shattered fragments of what once was a clear and compelling vision. But by avoiding contentious factionism, you have created a strong movement. And I will confess to you that I was skeptical when Bob McChesney and John Nichols first raised with me the issue of media consolidation a few years ago. I was sympathetic, but skeptical. The challenge of actually doing something about this issue beyond simply bemoaning its impact on democracy was daunting. How could we hope to come up with an effective response to an inexorable force? It seemed inexorable because all over the previous decades, a series of mega media mergers had swept the country, each deal bigger than the last. The lobby representing the broadcast, cable, and newspaper industry was extremely powerful, with an iron grip on lawmakers and regulators alike. Both parties bowed to their will when the Republican Congress passed and President Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act of 1996. That monstrous assault on democracy, with malignant consequences for journalism, was nothing but a welfare giveaway to the largest, richest, and most powerful media conglomerations in the world. Goliaths, whose handful of owners controlled, commodified, and monetized everyone and everything in sight. Call it the plantation mentality. That's what struck me as I flew into Memphis for this evening, for this gathering. Even in 1968, the civil rights movement was still battling the plantation mentality based on race, gender, and power that permeated Southern culture long before and even after the groundbreaking legislation of the 1960s. When Martin Luther King came to Memphis to join the strike of garbage workers in 1968, the cry from every striker's heart, "I am a man," voiced the long-suppressed outrage of people whose rights were still being trampled by an ownership class that had arranged the world for its own benefit. The plantation mentality is a phenomenon deeply insinuated in the American experience early on, and it has permeated and corrupted our course as a nation. The journalist of the American Revolution, Thomas Paine, envisioned the new republic as a community of occupations prospering by the aid with which each receives from the other and from the whole. But that vision was repeatedly betrayed, so that less than a century after Thomas Paine's death, Theodore Roosevelt, bolting a Republican Party whose bosses had stolen the nomination from him, declared, "It is not to be wondered at that our opponents have been very bitter, for the lineup in this crisis is one that cuts deep to the foundations of democracy. Our democracy," he said, "is now put to a vital test, for the conflict is between human rights on the one side and on the other special privilege asserted as property rights. The parting of the ways has come." Today, 100 years after Teddy Roosevelt's death, those words ring just as true. America is socially divided and politically benighted. Inequality and poverty grow steadily along with risk and debt. Too many working families cannot make ends meet with two people working, let alone if one stays home to care for children or aging parents. Young people without privilege and wealth struggle to get a footing. Seniors enjoy less security for a lifetime's work. We are racially segregated today in every meaningful sense except for the letter of the law. And the survivors of segregation and immigration toil for pennies on the dollar compared to those they serve. None of this is accidental. Nobel laureate economist Robert Salow, not known for extreme political statements, characterizes what is happening as nothing less than elite plunder, the redistribution of wealth in favor of the wealthy and of power in favor of the powerful. In fact, nearly all the wealth America created over the past 25 years has been captured by the top 20% of households, and most of the gains went to the wealthiest. The top 1% of households captured more than 50% of all the gains in financial wealth, and these households now hold more than twice the share their predecessors held on the eve of the American Revolution. The anti-federalist warning that government naturally works to fortify the conspiracies of the rich proved prophetic. It's the truth today, and America confronts a choice between two fundamentally different economic visions. As Norman Garfinkel writes in his marvelous new book, The American Dream versus the Gospel of Wealth, the historic vision of the American dream is that continuing economic growth and political stability can be achieved by supporting income growth and economic security of middle-class families without restricting the ability of successful businessmen to gain wealth. The counter belief is that providing maximum financial rewards to the most successful is the way to maintain high economic growth. The choice cannot be avoided. What kind of economy do we seek, and what kind of nation do we wish to be? Do we want to be a country in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, or do we want a country committed to an economy that provides for the common good, offers upward mobility, supports a middle-class standard of living, and provides generous opportunities for all? In Garfinkel's book, when Garfinkel says, the richest nation in the world has to borrow hundreds of billions of dollars to pay its bill, when its middle-class citizens sit on a mountain of debt to maintain their living standards, when the nation's economy has difficulty producing secure jobs or enough jobs of any kind, something is amiss. You bet something is amiss. And it goes to the core of why we are here in Memphis. For this conference is about a force, the media, that cuts deep to the foundation of democracy. When Teddy Roosevelt dissected what he called the real masters of the reactionary forces in his time, he concluded that indirectly or directly, they control the majority of the great newspapers that are against us. Those newspapers, the dominant media of the day, choked, his words, the channels of the information ordinary people needed to understand what was being done to them. And today, well, two basic pillars of American society, shared economic prosperity and a public sector capable of serving the common good, are crumbling. The third pillar of American democracy, an independent press, is under sustained attack, and the channels of information are choked. A few huge corporations now dominate the media landscape in America. Almost all the networks carried by most cable systems are owned by one of the major media conglomerates. Two-thirds of today's newspapers are monopolies. As ownership gets more and more concentrated, fewer and fewer independent sources of information have survived in the marketplace. And those few significant alternatives that do survive, such as PBS and NPR, are under growing financial and political pressure to reduce critical news content and to shift their focus in a mainstream direction, which means being more attentive to establishment views than to the bleak realities of powerlessness that shape the lives of ordinary people. What does today's media system mean for the notion of an informed public cherished by democratic theory? Quite literally, it means that virtually everything the average person sees or hears outside of her own personal communications is determined by the interest of private, unaccountable executives and investors whose primary goal is increasing profits and raising the country's share price. More insidiously, this small group of elites determine what ordinary people do not see or hear. In-depth coverage of anything, let alone the problems real people face day to day, is as scarce as sex, violence, and voyeurism are pervasive. Successful business model or not, by democratic standards, this is censorship of knowledge, by monopolization of the means of information. In its current form, which Barry Diller happily describes as oligopoly, media growth has one clear consequence. There is more information and easier access to it, but it's more narrow and homogeneous in content and perspective, so that what we see from the couch is overwhelmingly a view from the top. The pioneering communication scholar Murray Edelman wrote that opinions about public policy do not spring immaculately or automatically into people's minds. They're always placed there by the interpretations of those who most consistently get their claims and manufactured cues publicized widely. For years, the media marketplace for opinions about public policy has been dominated by a highly disciplined, thoroughly networked ideological noise machine, to use David Brock's term, permeated with slogans concocted by big corporations, their lobbyists, and their think tank subsidiaries. Public discourse has effectively changed the meaning of American values. Day after day, the ideals of fairness and liberty and mutual responsibility have been stripped of their essential dignity and meaning in people's lives. Day after day, the egalitarian creed of our Declaration of Independence is trampled underfoot by hired experts and sloganeers who speak of the death tax, the ownership society, the culture of life, the liberal assault on God and family, compassionate conservatism, weak on terrorism, the end of history, the clash of civilizations, no child left behind. They have even managed to turn the escalation of a failed war into a surge. As if it were a current of electricity through a wire instead of blood spurting from the ruptured vein of a soldier. The Orwellian filigree of a public sphere in which language conceals reality and the pursuit of personal gain and partisan power is wrapped in rhetoric that turns truth to lies and lies to truth. So it is that limited government has little to do with the Constitution or local autonomy anymore. Now it means corporate domination and the shifting of risk from government and business to struggling families and workers. Family values now mean imposing a sectarian definition on the family of the family on everyone else. Religious freedom now means majoritarianism and public benefits for organized religion without any public burdens. And patriotism has come to mean blind support for failed leaders. It's what happens when an interlocking media system filters through commercial values or ideology the information and moral viewpoints people consume in their daily lives. And by no stretch of the imagination can we say today that the dominant institutions of our media are guardians of democracy. Despite the profusion of new information platforms on cable, on the internet, on radio, blogs, podcasts, YouTube, and MySpace, among others, the resources for solid, original journalistic work, both investigative and interpretive, are contracting rather than expanding. I'm a fogey at this, I guess. A hangover from my days as a cub reporter and a newspaper publisher. But I agree with Michael Schutzen, one of the leading scholars of communication in America, who writes in the current Columbia Journalism Review that while all media matter, some matter more than others. And for the sake of democracy, print still counts most, especially print that devotes resources to gathering news. Network TV matters, he said. Cable TV matters, he said. But when it comes to original investigation and reporting, newspapers are overwhelmingly the most important media. But newspapers are purposely dumbing down, driven down, says Schutzen, by Wall Street, whose collective devotion to an informed citizenry is nil and seems determined to eviscerate those papers. Worrying about the loss of real news is not a romantic cliche of journalism. It's been verified by history. From the days of royal absolutism to the present, the control of information and knowledge had been the first line of defense for failed regimes facing democratic unrest. The suppression of parliamentary dissent during Charles I's 11 years' tyranny in England rested largely on government censorship operating through strict licensing laws for the publication of books. The Federalist infamous Sedition Act of 1798 in this country, likewise, sought to quell Republican insurgency by making it a crime to publish false, scandalous, and malicious writing about the government or its officials. In those days, our governing bodies tried to squelch journalistic information with the blunt instruments of the law. Padlocks for the presses and jail cells for outspoken editors and writers. Over time, with spectacular wartime exceptions, the courts and the Constitution have struck those weapons out of their hand. But now they've found new methods in the name of national security and even broader claims of executive privilege. The number of documents stamped top secret, secret or confidential, has accelerated dramatically since 2001, including many formerly accessible documents which are now reclassified as secret. Vice President Cheney's office refuses to disclose, in fact, what it is classifying. Even their secrecy is being kept a secret. Beyond what is officially labeled secret or privileged information, there hovers on the plantation a culture of selective official news implementation, working through favored media insiders to advance political agendas by leak and innuendo and spin, by outright propaganda mechanisms such as the misnamed public information offices that churn out blizzards of factually selective releases on a daily basis, and even by directly paying pundits and journalists to write on subjects of mutual interest. They needn't have wasted the money. As we saw in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, the plantation mentality that governs Washington turned the press corps into sitting ducks for the war party, for government and neoconservative propaganda and manipulation. There were notable exceptions, Knight Ridder's bureau, for example, but on the whole, all high-ranking officials had to do was say it, and the press repeated it until it became gospel. The height of myopia came with the admission, or was it bragging, by one of the Beltway's most prominent anchors that his responsibility is to provide officials a forum to be heard. What they say, more newsworthy than what they do. The watchdog group FAIR found that during the 3 weeks leading up to the invasion, only 3% of U.S. sources on the evening news of ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, and PBS expressed skeptical opinions of the impending war, even though a quarter of the American people were against it. Not surprisingly, 2 years after 9/11, almost 70% of the public still thought it likely that Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the terrorist attacks of that day. One Indiana school teacher told the Washington Post, quote, "From what we've heard from the media, it seems like what they feel is that Saddam and the whole al-Qaeda thing are connected." Much to the advantage of the Bush administration, a large majority of the public shared this erroneous view during the buildup to the war, a propaganda feat that Saddam himself would have envied. It is absolutely, I'm doing a documentary to air this spring called Buying the War on this period leading up to the invasion. It is absolutely stunning, frightening, how the major media organizations were willing, even solicitous hand puppets of a state propaganda campaign cheered on by the partisan ideological press, to go to war. But there are many other ways the plantation mentality keeps the American people from confronting reality. Take the staggering growth of money in politics. Compared to the magnitude of the problem, what the average person knows about how money determines policy is negligible. In fact, in the abstract, the polls tell us, most people generally assume that money controls our political system. But people will rarely act on something they understand, only in the abstract. It took a constant stream of images, water hoses and dogs and churches ablaze, for the public at large finally to understand what was happening to black people in the South. It took repeated scenes of destruction in Vietnam before the majority of Americans saw how we were destroying the country in order to save it. And it took repeated crime scene images to maintain public support, policing and sentencing policies. Likewise, people have to see how money in politics actually worked and concretely grasp the consequences for their pocketbooks and their lives before they will act. But while media organizations supply a lot of news and commentary, they tell us almost nothing about who really wags the system and how. When I watch one of those faux debates on a Washington Public Affairs show, with one politician saying this is a bad bill and the other politician saying this is a good bill, I yearn to see the smiling, nodding Beltway anchor suddenly interrupt and insist, good bill or bad bill, this is a bought bill. Now let's cut to the chase. Whose financial interest are you advancing with this bill? Then there's the social cost of free trade. For over a decade, free trade has hovered over the political system like a biblical commandment, striking down anything trade unions, the environment, indigenous rights, even the constitutional standing of our own laws passed by our elected representative that gets in the way of unbridled greed. The broader negative consequences of this agenda, increasingly well documented by scholars, gets virtually no attention in the dominant media. Instead of reality, we get optimistic multicultural scenarios of coordinated global growth. And instead of substantive debate, we get a stark, formulaic choice between free trade to help the world and gloomy-sounding protectionism that will set everybody back. The degree to which this has become a purely ideological debate, devoid of any factual basis that people can weigh the gains and losses, is reflected in Thomas Friedman's astonishing claim, stated not long ago in a television interview, that he endorsed the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, without even reading it. That is, simply because it stood for, quote, free trade. We have reached the stage when the poobahs of punditry have only to declare that the world is flat for everyone to agree it is without going to the edge and looking over themselves.
You're listening to Bill Moyers on Media Reform. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
It's called reporting. I think what's happened is not indifference or laziness or incompetence, but the fact that most journalists on the plantation have so internalized conventional wisdom that they simply accept that the system is working as it should. That documentary I told you about, Buying the War, I can't tell you again how many reporters have told me that it just never occurred to them that high officials would manipulate intelligence in order to go to war. Hello? Similarly, the question of whether or not our economic system is truly just is off the table for investigation and discussion, so that alternative ideas, alternative critiques, alternative visions never get a hearing. And these are but a few of the realities that are obscured. What about this growing inequality? What about the resegregation of our public schools? What about the devastating onward march of environmental deregulation? All examples of what happens when independent sources of knowledge and analysis are so few and far between on the plantation. So if we need to know what is happening and big media won't tell us, if we need to know why it matters and big media won't tell us, if we need to know what to do about it and big media won't tell us, it's clear what we have to do. We have to tell the story ourselves. And this is what the plantation owners feared most of all. Over all those decades here in the South when they used human beings as chattel and quoted scripture to justify it, property rights over human rights was God's way. They secretly lived in fear that one day, instead of saying, "Yes, massa," those gaunt, weary, sweat-soaked field hands bending low over the cotton under the burning sun would suddenly stand up straight, look around, see their sweltering and stooping kin, and say, "This ain't the product of intelligent design." The boss man in the big house has been lying to me. Something is wrong with this system. This is the moment freedom begins. The moment you realize someone else has been writing your story, and it's time you took the pen from his hand and started writing it yourself. When the garbage workers struck here in 1968 and the walls of these buildings echoed with the cry, "I am a man," they were writing their story. Martin Luther King came here to help them tell it, only beat a shot dead on the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel Motel. The bullet killed him, but it couldn't kill the story, because once the people start telling their story, you can't kill it anymore. So I'm back where I started with you.